Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Hey, Stone. How was your weekend?
It was just marvelous. We had Father's Day, and we grilled out and had pork loin, and I came away with a very nice watch. How did it go for you?
Went well. You got a watch. I got a heart rate monitor. I don't know what my family is trying to tell me.
Too funny. We had a good week last week, too, leading up to Father's Day. I had a lot of fun, and I know you did, too. Was it Wednesday evening or Thursday evening that we were out there at the Wit Connect?
That's right. It was at the aquarium. Beautiful location for an event, and it was the Women in Technology celebrating their, big fundraiser for them.
Well, and for our listeners who don't know, apparently there continues to be a real dearth in young females going into careers that involve science, technology, engineering, and math, and these good folks are trying to put some real energy and resources behind that.
Right. It was an interesting event where they would auction off time with chief information officers.
Like for crazy money, or
right.
by mine and your standards,
exactly.
Crazy money.
Like, what is it? A meeting could be, people were bidding $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 to have a meeting with these chief information officers of some fairly large companies around town.
And then the kid that works with us, we said, go tell them we want 20 minutes with them on the radio, and we didn't pay anything. Did that make you feel a little bit guilty?
You don't want to give away our secrets.
Right. So this is going to be a fun show this morning. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from Bob Eckert with New and Improved. We're going to hear from author Mark Anthony Peterson. And I get the indication because Lee's playing on the phone. We might even get Andy Mack in here from Comcast. But first up on High Velocity Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce a lady with Leadership Futures, Inc., a human capital strategy firm, Miss Karen Stedman. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Don't let that mic whip you now. Get on in there and talk.
You
got to
get in there, Karen.
Good morning.
There you go. Karen is in the building now. So, human capital strategy firm, I know all about that stuff, but Lee doesn't have a clue. What kind of work do you guys do?
We make sure that your business strategy actually happens because you have to have the right talent on board. Your talent strategy is going to drive your business strategy. So, we work with the people.
The people. Or is that the most important thing? You think like a good strategy with mediocre people, that's not going to work out?
I say yes. You have to. You don't want to bet on the horse. You want to bet on the jockey.
And so how did you get in this line of work? What were you doing before this?
Well, it's interesting you were talking about women in technology. I am actually a techie at heart. My undergrad is from Georgia Tech, right down the road, one of these directions. Mm-hmm. And I was the engineer. I was in industrial systems engineering and optimization and human factors design, which is a really sexy word for let's just make sure that the people are working well within the system. But I would sit back in class and I'd say, gosh, it sure looks like a lot of numbers. We're really not talking about the people. So I shifted gears. I'm a corporate psychologist, and I analyze people for a living.
Now, you have a real affinity for, apparently, analytical leaders, or choose to focus on analytical leaders. What's the story behind that?
Well, if you're one of them, then you will agree. And if you're not one of them, you may be married to one, which is very analytical people just see the world differently. It's not just a spectrum of colors. It's often black and white. It's not just, how are we going to get there? Let's plot a flow chart for how we're going to get there. It's not just, what makes you happy? It's more what makes me happy, and let me put that in a spreadsheet three or four different ways. So I think analytical people by nature analyze everything that they see, and that's a good thing until you need to do more than that. And so the leaders I work with are typically extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily savvy in their technical expertise, but they need a little shine with their human factor.
Now, are analytical leaders typically more successful than non-analytical leaders?
To a point, yes. To a point, yes. They're very strong at getting the results, but then they don't always change and shift their ways as mm-hmm. quickly as everybody else. So sometimes they're the last person to see that what worked last week or last year may not work going forward.
So you help them in there to be a little more nimble?
Be a little bit more nimble and sometimes take their head out of the sand and see what are other people doing and mm-hmm. where else can I get expertise.
So what has been your success rate, your experience in people actually affecting any substantive degree of change? Can a person really change their stripes?
I think the answer is yes, a person can change their stripes, but they have to want to. And that may seem very insignificant, but I have had people who you would be shocked that the amount of change that they've done in just that quick. And I know that we'll be speaking here with Bob on innovation. Many of our innovative leaders really have all the skills they need, but they won't change enough to maybe open up their audience to hearing a different perspective.
Now, what's the pain that they're having that kind of moves them to change?
Well, I see analytical leaders really fall in several camps. Sometimes they're extremely competitive, mm-hmm. and that would make them move to a different place. Or sometimes they realize that they've been too cautious, or I like to call it constrained. They've really not been able to get where they thought they would be until they take the gloves off.
I know I once had a mentor that suggested that some folks are just too smart to be successful. You know, it's not complicated enough for them. Is there some truth to that in your experience?
Too smart to be successful? Absolutely. I mean, I have one client, bless his heart. He's probably brilliant in every way you could assess this person. But he takes so long to make a decision because he just keeps analyzing. He's not bold enough to actually try and fail, which is one of the main things you have to do if you're going to be innovative. You've got to be able to fail quickly, or else you're not going to get to the next level. So I think they eat in on themselves if they're not willing to open
but
up.
But isn't that strange in that he would work with you, so he knew that there is a problem, or else he wouldn't be working with you.
Well, actually,
and yet
some,
he wouldn't pull the trigger in actually changing.
You'd be surprised how sometimes it's someone else that points it out to them. Their organization, maybe it's the shareholders, maybe it's the board who said, you know, I have one client where just in the past 5 years, their business model has shifted from all United States to 51% outside of the United States. Their CFO needs to work differently. He did not come and ask for this kind of a talent profile and help for himself. His board did.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned the term a moment ago, mentor. I've mm-hmm. been blessed in a lot of ways, not the least of which is I've had a couple of mentors. What's your experience with that? Have you had a chance to be a mentor or a, what do you call the other
mentee.
Side of that?
Mentee.
A mentee. That's right, the mentor, mentee, coach, coachee. I have had several mentors. I would say my father and my father's side, they have been very interesting. I come from a very academic, technical family. My grandfather actually worked on the Manhattan Project.
Oh, wow.
Which was very interesting. But what was important in our family is the men had to learn how to scramble eggs and the women had to learn to work on cars. So that was the theme in my family. Mm-hmm. But I think that was an important one that you couldn't just, obviously these are stereotypes as well, but just you couldn't fit into the stereotypes. My parents and my family really wanted us to work differently. So I think that was important.
Now, I understand you have a book coming out.
I do. I have a book coming out, which I'm very excited about. It's called Pioneer, Why Stop It Successful. And I think it's because I really see these beyond bright people maybe dabble in innovative ways, maybe try to adapt. But honestly, we need more than that. We need them to pioneer, take us to new levels, and really kind of crack the code on what they've already done in the past.
Now, do you see yourself as a pioneer?
I would, actually. I think in my field, which is in the executive assessment coaching field, many people have come from working out in corporate America or beyond and then coming to this field.
Mm-hmm.
I've trained and consulted and really started out in this field. So I've been doing it a long time with kind of practicing and researching at the same time. And I'm a redhead, which... there aren't that many female redheaded engineers working in strategy. I'll just be honest. One of my other mentors is Marshall Goldsmith. I don't know if you know Marshall Goldsmith, but Marshall says that he has the world cornered on the kind of gray haired older men. He wants me to corner the redheaded strategist in human capital.
So. That's perfect. So tell us a little bit more about this book. What did you find the most fun? What did you enjoy the most? And what did you find a little bit challenging, if not maybe downright frustrating in that process?
Well, I think one of the most fun things is just reading about pioneers. I mean, you're going to go out today and see that word is everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere, and I think there's a reason for that. It's because we need more people being pioneers. Mm. So interviewing, looking up pioneers across the world, I really wanted to see what makes these people tick. How are they different? And what I think was one of the most fun is that reading about all sorts of pioneers, some famous, some not so famous yet, they're really more similar than they are different. So one of the pioneers, obviously I didn't interview her because she's been passed on for a while. I picture and I profile a 13-year-old girl who goes on the gold rush with her family. And some of the quotes that she uses are very similar to MLK, to a couple of other people I'm profiling from the technology space. They're very different from where they've lived and who they are, but they're very similar in how they approach pioneering. So that's what's fun. What's not as fun is it is very hard to narrow this down. Hmm. And maybe I want to hear a little bit of your advice, but you could just write a book every minute of the day. Mm. At least it feels like it. So it's hard. I want to capture these people, their spirits correctly. So that's probably the hardest part.
Now, you have a consulting practice, and obviously you're very passionate about your work, but how do you even get on the radar of people who will write you a check to help them or people inside their company? That's got to be a real challenge, I would think, marketing your practice. You're out practicing your craft, so while you're practicing your craft, you're not marketing your practice. Mm-hmm. Speak to that a little bit, if you will.
Well, I think it is a challenge. You have to really give the most you can to your clients and then also be out looking for where are my next clients. I work by referral mostly because it's almost like hiring a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. If you're really going to have someone do a talent profile on you, you need to have a lot of trust that that's someone who's going to do it well. But I bump into people everywhere. I find clients at one of my last clients this past year. I was sitting in first class on a plane, and we were just talking about business and why business isn't why his business wasn't where he wanted it to be growth wise. And so that's one way we connected. But I think that especially here in Atlanta, there's some really interesting networks that are trying to promote you as a leader, either a small business person or if you're involved in Fortune 500, just getting connected to people. They seem to want to do better is my take.
Well, let's don't keep your light under a bushel anymore. Let's make sure our listeners know how to get in touch with you. What's the best way for them to reach out if they'd like to have a substantive conversation about some of these topics?
Well, I keep my LinkedIn page up to date because I think people really find that a good help as to, what am I reading, what am I doing, where am I going to be speaking. And then my website would be karen.stedman@leadershipfutures.com.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this morning. And I tell you what would be fun if you'd be up for it. I think it would be a lot of fun and very interesting for our listeners if you were to come back to the studio sometime, maybe bring a delighted client and talk a little bit about the process from their standpoint. Would you be up for that sometime?
Absolutely.
Great. Hey, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Sounds good. I want to learn something this morning for sure.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Well, next up on High Velocity Radio, Lee, all the way from the great state of New York, the CEO, the grand poobah, the leader of an outfit called New and Improved LLC, Mr. Bob Eckert. Welcome to the show, man.
Well, it's great to be a poobah.
Well, you must be learning something. I saw you nodding your head and taking notes while we spoke with Karen Stedman. So what brings you to Atlanta? And while you're describing that, give us a little bit of a feel for what New and Improved is out there doing for folks.
Sure. Well, we're down here this week for the Creative Problem Solving Institute.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is the oldest creativity and innovation-focused conference on the planet. I think it's the 56th, 57th year of this conference. Very sophisticated conference. It was there before there were any others. It was there was a time when it was essentially the only conference on the planet, and then a couple more appeared here in the U.S., and then one in Europe, then one in South Africa. And now, and we all knew each other. Everyone in the field knew each other at that point. And in the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years, we've seen a proliferation of interest in innovation. And as that's happened, there's been great opportunity for lots of folks. And now there's probably an innovation and creativity conference just in the States every week. And if you look at it globally, it's darn near every day. So that's what that is. And that conference is going on. There's still slots. You can still come down. It's at the Sheraton for the next 3 days. There's different types of programs. Some of the greatest thinkers in the innovation field in the world speak at this conference and come together, and it's a great place to be. It's also a heck of a lot of fun. It's creativity. The font of innovation is human creativity, so we get to play, and we get to think in different ways, and so that's real cool.
So innovation strikes me as one of those words where we could both be using the same word in the conversation and both mean two completely different things. Is that consistent with your experience?
It sure is. I was actually sitting across the way having coffee this morning, and there was a conversation that grabbed my ear. Somebody was speaking about innovation. The two people on a table next to me at Starbucks across the way. And somebody was talking about innovation at the company that's also in this building. And And they were talking about products. You know, in their case, they're specifically speaking of products. Now, you know, Karen, you'll know that a coach who approaches innovation in an interesting way or a way that somebody writes more effectively, there's innovation there. And so one of the things that's been interesting with kind of, I guess, the proliferation of instant experts on innovation, somewhat driven by a recession, and there's certainly a lot more consulting practices that start during a recession because you got to find work. And if you're entrepreneurial and you think you know something about something, you might as well go out and start to do that. So when we think about innovation at New and Improved, what we're thinking about innovation is being driven by creative thinking of an individual, then collaborative creativity amongst a group of individuals, driving forward something that's new and gives value. So that sometimes is a product, you know, that's the way we think about it, or a service, which would be a product in the service industry. But sometimes it's the board of directors figuring out a better way to get the CFO to give his or her value to the organization. And it was that board member who said to someone, Karen, you know, we need to do something with our CFO. And then they have a piece of information and they come up with an idea and they move that idea forward in the organization. And you can be sure there was a political conversation that happened and the subtlety of, well, how do we broach that with this person? All of that requires creative thinking as well. Or we create a new human resource policy. Or we think about how might we help our people be more creative on a day-to-day basis so that an administrative assistant or a floor technician in a manufacturing facility can modify the way they do their work. So you got to think about it more broadly than just a product. And those companies that only think about it as products are beginning to lose share. Their boards are beginning to be concerned. They're talking to the CEOs. CEOs are calling us and saying, what can we do to make our company fundamentally more innovative versus just, hey, we got a new product introduction coming through in our pipeline.
Now, when you guys work with your clients, are you coming in there to be the innovators or are you coming in there to teach their existing people how to be more innovative?
Teach them to fish. So we're
Premise then is that they have enough people who can fish already there.
Yeah, absolutely. You just have to unleash that human capital. You have to move that.
So you think anybody could be innovative?
I do. And
anybody?
Anybody.
Evenly.
Even me.
Yep, yep.
You
yep.
don't know me very well.
You know, we may have to plug some things in here and shock you a little bit, but sure. You know, we all can. It's one of these bell curve capacities that all human beings have. And in it, with a little bit of work,
and you have research to back that up?
Absolutely.
That everybody's on the bell curve goes from 0 to 100, right?
So right, make a number
everybody
up.
Will be in there somewhere.
Make a number up, right. And so even some of the folks that are rapidly productive in the area of innovation, one of the metrics that a lot of companies will use is how many patents does an individual have? There are ways to work with them, ways to connect them up in the organization. It's not just me having a creative thought on my own. Karen, you were talking about these really bright people that sometimes get in their own way. They're geniuses in their own way. But then the issue that's blocking their innovation oftentimes is their ability to collaborate productively with other people. So it's fair game if you're wanting to drive more innovation in your human resource to find ways, and you can do this both with kind of coaching, psychodynamic work with that individual, but you can also do it with systems, with metrics in their accountability, metrics in their performance appraisal. There are all kinds of interesting moves you can make to unleash that. So, and then, so commonly, and we see this in all human systems, when we get to a larger group of people, we become a bureaucracy, whether we're a government or a corporation or even a small business, small family firm that's growing its way up, and we get a way of being with each other that is protective. We've had success. So the human brain, being the primitive thing that it is sometimes, wants to protect success by doing what we've already done. Because that got us here, so why not keep doing it? Well, you can buy evolution or not buy evolution as a science with human beings, but you'd have to be daft to not see it in commerce. There is competitive pressure in commerce. There is selection pressure in commerce. There is survival of the fittest in commerce. So if you're not constantly improving, constantly evolving yourself, constantly driving for the next new thing, and you have any competitors in your niche, you're in trouble because they are. And it, right now the game is who learns the fundamental practices of innovation more effectively and embeds it in their culture. So you take a consumer packaged goods business, you know, take the Procter & Gamble's, the Coca-Cola's, the Kimberly-Clark's, the Unilever's of the world. Whichever one kind of builds that culture best in a sustainable way, and it's a sine wave, you know, they come and go with it, but they're going to take market share. They're going to retain employees. They're going to do better for their shareholders. And so that's the game right now.
Are there more tools, methodologies, strategies, and tactics available to companies and individuals who genuinely want to be more innovative? Are there more of those things available now than there used to be? Or is it like you thumb through a golf magazine and you got a gazillion gadgets and it all comes down to just a few simple things that everybody ought to be doing?
Yeah, it is. It is an interesting thing. There are some basics that have been demonstrated by the research that, you know, we've got a body of 60 years now in the U.S. of good peer-reviewed scientific academic research. There's a journal of creative behavior. There's a scientific peer-reviewed journal that this group that's in town this week at the Creative Problem Solving Institute, which is sponsored by the Creative Education Foundation, which was formed by the two gentlemen that coined the term brainstorming back in the 1950s out of Buffalo State University. And that's the place 80% of my staff has a master's degree in the study of the science of creativity and innovation. The master's is a master's in creativity and change leadership from the International Center for Creative Studies at Buff State. There's science here. Now, are there a lot of tools and is there a lot of noise? Sure. So what people will do, just like any industry, so I'm a mountaineer, rock climber, backpacker, mountain biker kind of guy. And I used to have two stores when I was younger in Cincinnati, Ohio that sold that stuff. And I know that when I go into a store today and somebody shows me the difference between this front fork mountain bike shock and that front fork mountain bike shock, and they're making a big deal out of a little difference, it is just that. It's a big deal out of a little difference, but that's how you've got to do that. So what's happened right now in the field with so much interest in innovation, there is, you got to be careful, there is a bit of snake oil going on in that people are making big deals out of a little difference because they're trying to carve a niche in the market. There will be a settling out, and we're beginning to see that happen right now. And there will be a bit of a backlash, too, like there always is with these things where folks will come into it, they'll make a bad buy, and they'll say, that didn't work. The danger is a bad buy at a senior level in an organization creates a dynamic. Let's say, here's a case example, and I can't tell you the company, of course, but so one company decided that they wanted to be more innovative. They brought a consultant in. The consultant said, you know what you need is a more innovative environment that your employees are visually stimulated to be more innovative. So now that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing, but it needs to be done in a broader context. But this company, that was their first move. So they spent a bunch of money building this great innovation space, if you will, beanbag chairs. And they even had a slide where you'd slide down from the first floor or the second floor to the first and land in a thing of balls, like at the at the kids' places, you know, right? Chuck E. Cheese or whatever. And so they were doing that. Of course, everybody's credit cards that they had in their wallets were demagnetizing as they're sliding down that slide from the static electricity. But it's a cool spot. And they have technology on the tables and booths. And if you started to spend too much time there and your manager needed you to deliver on the deliverables that he or she was responsible for, the pressure started to be, what are you doing? And that was their first and only significant move. So what happened is the CFO said, look, we spent all this money in, you know, senior meetings with the executive staff. We spent all this money and I don't see the ROI. So don't be talking to me about spending more money on innovation when we need to build a new factory to make the goods to sell to the people that want to buy them, right? So they came at it with an unintegrated approach, and that's the danger.
So I understand you're an author as well. It seems like the whole studio is filled with authors today, Lee. Tell us a little bit about your book and what you were trying to accomplish with that.
Well, ultimately, if you want to drive an innovative organization, it comes down to the people, stupid. You know, it's the people, stupid. We can build metrics, we can build systems, but it's the human brains that populate those systems that make a difference. So the book's called More Lightning, Less Thunder, Energizing Innovative Teams. It comes from a Mark Twain quote. Mark Twain once said, thunder is good, thunder is great, but it's lightning that does the work. And so what ends up happening is that we decided in this book to focus on my co-author, Jonathan Vihar, who's at the Center for Creative Leadership over in Greensboro. We decided to take a look at what are the things that help individual human beings improve their ability to both innovate personally, to innovate in a team, and then to lead teams that might innovate better, and then to manage multiple teams as a mid-level manager such that they can move forward in changing the culture of their organization to be more innovative. And then from that, what we find is that if you improve your personal ability to do this, you make it an important thing in your life, you'll build the systems. There's four things you have to focus on. You have to focus on the overall systems. You have to focus on your culture. You have to focus on the people. And, of course, you have to focus on your service or product. Well, if you improve the people, the culture, the systems, the service, and the product will improve. If you only focus on the product, you may get a nice bump in share or sales, but as that deteriorates, you've got nothing in your pipeline because you haven't focused on the brains that make up your organization. So that's what the book was really focused on.
So how do we get our hands on this book? And while you're at it, what's the best way for our listeners to learn more about New and Improved LLC and reach out to you and your staff to talk about this topic that's certainly not going anywhere of innovation?
Well, like all things these days, the fastest way to get a book is go to Amazon.
Right, right.
You know, they get it to you quick, and if you got one of those, you'll have it in less than 24 hours, it seems. There's innovation, you know, overnight delivery, FedEx,
yeah.
Right? So that's the easiest way. More Lightning, Less Thunder by Eckert and Vihar. And then New and Improved, put New and Improved into a search engine. Go ahead, try. You know, in our culture, that's kind of one of those words. So it's newandimproved.com. That's our, with an A-N-D. So that's us. And we're a global company. We've got folks, we practice in seven languages. And got folks all over the world. So you could, different offices, but our main office is in northern New York. And the website points you up to us.
Well, Bob Eckert with New and Improved, thanks so much for coming by and hanging out with us. I know you're busy and you got this conference to go to. Have you got a little while to hang out with us while
you're
visiting with our other guests?
You got me for the time you need.
All right. Fantastic. Well, next up, Lee, surprise, surprise, we have another author in the
really?
Studio.
I thought there was an author shortage.
And comes to us through our good buddy, Amy Otto. So a little shout out to Amy Otto, who always does a fantastic job of putting us in touch with strong, passionate, smart folks. This gentleman has written the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths. Welcome to the show, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, you've been very polite and very patient, waiting in the wings, heard our other couple of interviews. But I got the idea you were getting some value out of those conversations.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about this book and what you were trying to accomplish when you decided to sit down and write
it. Sure. You wouldn't think from my background that I'd be focused so much on small business. I started out as a strategy consultant with Accenture and spent time with a number of Fortune 500 companies as managing executive in charge of their incubators. And I think that's where my passion started in looking at small businesses, doing those types of jobs. What I wanted to accomplish with the book was to try to lay out strategies and tactics to help small businesses be more successful in their markets. And point out in the book, by looking at a number of small business cases and vignettes in the book, that look at companies today that we think as global leaders and point out those common themes that when they were small businesses helped them to be successful. And, you know, that's the overarching theme. I try to also lay out the path for small businesses to extend the runway. In a cash-strapped environment that we're in, where credit has pretty much been decimated for the small business person, how do you go about building up enough capital to weather the storms that you're going to face when competing against Goliaths or large corporations? And my goal in that is to try to encourage small businesses as well as large to embrace more of a green approach to conserving capital. Use what you have before you spend to create new buildings, new storefronts, take what you have, recycle, repurpose, and extend that runway for the small business person.
So now when you're saying green, you're not necessarily meaning environmentally green. You're using that as a metaphor?
No, I mean environmentally green. When I left Choice Point, which was the last corporate job, I started a company called Prod Rock Holdings. Mm-hmm. It was a biometric company designed to help capture fingerprints for background checks. My competitors thought the best way to do that was to build storefronts and launch that all around the world with a lot of new capital and a lot of new people. I took the same business model and deployed them in UPS stores. Saved me capital,
right?
But it also reduced the carbon footprint. I didn't have to put new people in cars driving back and forth to their homes when there were already people doing that.
So you created a partnership with the UPS stores?
Correct. And mail parcel centers. And I point out examples like that of corporations like JetBlue that have a large percentage of their customer service rep force home sourced, people mm-hmm. who actually pick up the phones from their home and book your tickets and answer your service calls.
Rather than have a call center or exactly. go into a building exactly. where there'd be extra. Now, how were you able to, because that's kind of a shift in the thinking.
Yes.
A lot of people think that I have to build this, therefore, but you're saying I have to partner smartly
exactly.
is maybe a better solution.
Right.
Now, how did you go about going to the UPS stores and convince them to give you some of their valuable real estate to put your business inside of?
Absolutely. Well, it was a perfect win-win. They have a lot of extra capacity.
Capacity and, meaning what? Space?
Space and time,
mm-hmm.
Which was exactly what I needed. I needed shelf space or counter space to
right.
put my equipment, and I needed a receptive workforce that is people-driven.
Right.
And they were the perfect match. So the interviews with the store owners were one where they could get transactional revenue in exchange for offering up their time and counter space. And it was a perfect marriage.
And then when you approached the UPS store people with this idea, did you say, okay, let's just pilot this somewhere and we'll see if this works? Or how did that kind of
absolutely.
Come about?
Absolutely. Our first customers with a small bank, and we approached a store in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we ran it out of two stores.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point, we went out like Johnny Appleseed and one by one set up 300 locations around uh-huh. the U.S. And the world.
And then you were learning and tweaking, and then you finally got it to where it was systematic, and then you were able to then say, okay, now let's blow this out to, I'm sure there's thousands of UPS stores around.
That's correct. Last count, we were over 300. Mm-hmm. We're running the system. 270 of those domestic, and you know, roughly 25 to 30 international.
Now, how much money do you think that saved you, as if you were going to write checks to create that space, build that out, and all that? It must have. You're talking millions of dollars.
70 million,
right?
If you're talking about storefronts, people,
and plus the risk. Now
yes.
you'd be on the hook for all that real estate and all that.
That's correct. And see, we even designed our systems so that we didn't even have to deploy PCs. Mm-hmm. It was a web-based application.
That they could use their existing.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. So I take those kinds of experiences and flip them back around for small business people and say, don't reinvent the wheel. The big guys who are big now, they learned those lessons when they were small, and they became very successful doing that.
Right. So it's kind of like the shark remora, where that you're kind of going, jumping onto the shark, right? And then
that's
you're
right.
using their strength and power,
absolutely.
And you're going along for the ride.
Absolutely.
And, but providing a service that's valuable to them that they can't necessarily do themselves.
That's correct. Now, at a certain point, you get big enough where you can be the shark, right? And that's it. And I point out those kind of examples. Honda, for example, the leaders of Honda sold patents to Toyota for many years. Even worked for them. The CEO did.
Uh-huh.
But you get to a certain point where you have knowledge, capability, resources, and enough of that runway given to you by that shark that you're circling
right.
and consuming their waste, that you get to be powerful enough to dominate. And so the book looks at strategies and frameworks that say, now is the time to be docile, but now is the time to be dominant. Now is the time to hit and run.
Right.
So I want to make small businesses smart enough to know to do exactly what you're talking about, when to hunt and when to hide.
Right. Now, when you approach the UPS, how come they gave you the time of day? Like, how did you get to somebody at a level that they gave you permission to get into that first UPS store? Did you go directly to that store owner?
Yeah, correct. First, you go to corporate, and you know that corporate always wants to introduce programs that are going to put more money in the pockets of the mm-hmm. of the franchisees. Though there's a corporate UPS store or a corporate postal net, each of the stores are owned individually.
Okay.
And so anytime you can approach them with a successful program that's going to put more money in the franchisee's hands, you get a good
They're
marriage.
Open to that.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So it once you get the blessing from corporate, it becomes an individual one-on-one sales job with each store owner.
So then the corporate is giving you permission to approach them with this idea, and they're kind of blessing it, saying that it's okay with us if you pursue this.
Right. But then you got to execute a contract right. with each one.
Individually.
That's right.
Now, I would think that working with virtual employees when you're a small company like this would fit into this paradigm pretty
Absolutely.
Neatly. But I have to say in the same breath, I got to believe there are some challenges in working with virtual employees because he's not right down the hall.
That's right.
You can,
mm-hmm.
So speak to that a little bit and how you would advise people like Lee and I.
Absolutely. I think you got to combine a little bit of everything that you heard from the previous office. So when you are interviewing the people that you make a part of your virtual organization, you have to have a framework or a template that tells you the people, the type of people you're looking for. Again, it's about people. So if you don't get the right type of franchisee, the person that loves to see someone walk through the door, someone that's customer focused, someone that's a little anal to make sure they're executing the techniques and following the systems perfectly, then you need to move on to the next door. The second thing you have to do is really innovate. Watch your process and be willing to recreate it every time you see that there's a snag in the workflow. So when we first started the Pride Rock, the fingerprint business, we were deploying these local apps on their PCs. You remember the old days of AOL when you had to send out CDs?
Right.
We had to do that. So we were mailing new CDs every week until these guys were like, you're killing us with all the CDs. So we had to come up with a better way to update that software with new functionality as opposed to mailing out new CDs. So we moved it from a local app to a server-based app. And that way, they would just wake up and the changes were already in the system. And that innovation, that continuous passion to reinvent the process, reinvent the workflow of that application, got us to a point where our people that needed to use the fingerprints would just print out a receipt, give it to that store owner. That store owner would zap it with a barcode, and the system step by step took them through everything. They didn't have to touch the keyboard. They didn't have to touch the screen. The system moved forward. As they completed the fingerprint or took a picture or got a signature, the system was smart enough to walk them through it without having any sort of human input. So it was a combination of innovation and looking for the right people to make a virtual workforce work.
Now, what for you personally is more rewarding, working in that kind of corporate environment where you're kind of making big, big decisions and they're affecting lots of people, or this kind of bootstrappy, boots on the ground, you're dealing with people on a kind of more of a one-to-one basis?
I like both. And in the book, that's the last chapter. I encourage corporations to never forget their roots and to always know when to go back and embrace the small business animal within them. Mm-hmm. And if they do that, I think they will continuously reinvent their business and grow. So I like to take small ideas to big places. And if I can convince small businesses to be successful, they'll be the corporations that invent how we think about business and I hope invent how we think about capital in our environment.
Now, do you see that as being so that real innovation and real breakthrough things happen kind of by the little guy and that he figures it out and then the bigger company with all the resources kind of find it and then blow it out to a larger...
Yeah, I'm hoping small businesses become big examples.
Right.
Walmart, when they started out, was a single store. And for the first 100 stores, they avoided all the Goliaths that they fought against, the Sears, the Kmarts.
Right, they were going into underserved small markets.
Exactly. And their business model forced everyone else in the industry to change how they thought about retail.
But it was almost too late once they had a big enough footprint.
Yes, exactly. What I call strategic chaos.
Uh-huh.
You work until you get to the point of creating strategic chaos for your competitors.
Right, and then you become disruptive, and then they got to deal with you, but you've already built an infrastructure that's
right.
already successful.
That's right. So if my small businesses that think the way I would hope they would think by reading the book, in the end, I want them to create the kind of chaos that forces companies to rethink their business models.
I'm using that on the 1 o'clock show, Strategic Chaos. And this show won't be out yet, so
it'll be perfect.
They'll think it's mine.
That's very innovative.
So that's innovative.
There you go, very innovative.
You gotta grab it where you can.
So did this book come together real easy for you? Was it a terrible labor? Tell us about the process.
It was beautiful. It was a combination of going back and paying homage to my my family, the people I grew up with. I had been taught the classic strategic consulting frameworks. But growing up, I lived around men and women who were shade tree mechanics, shade tree carpenters. And these individuals knew how to invest in their capability and avoid spending capital when they didn't need to. And so as I started to lay out the frameworks, I realized that these things were baked in me from the time I was a child. So the early chapters look at those early examples, and I migrated into the life experiences that I had as a consultant and then later as an entrepreneur myself. So it was one of those things that felt like a bucket list item by the time I was done, something you had to do.
Right.
But it was a lot of fun and reliving a lot of what I experienced growing up.
So now are you in this next chapter of your life, are you now just writing books and kind of speaking, or are you still getting your hands dirty?
Exactly.
And
I'm still
coming up with another small business that a big business will buy.
That's exactly. I'm a guerrillapreneur for life. We're about to launch a new initiative. Again, same sort of themes where we're going to leverage someone else's existing infrastructure and try to reinvent retailing this time. So we are looking forward to that. I do consulting.
Still. But you look for that. That's your kind of way you operate, is you look for the small thing that can fit into a larger organization.
And then
eventually does that get bought by the larger organization typically?
Yes. Fortunately for me, that biometric business did get bought by a spinoff from First American. CoreLogix bought the company. I do look back on that and go, wish I hadn't done that, because it had gotten to the point where we were over $15 million in revenue and had captured some of the world's largest banks and brokerages as clients. And the business model had played out exactly as we thought it would. But that just gave me time to go back and think of another concept and start over.
Do it again.
That's right.
Lee, I just gave this book my famous thumb test. For those of you who don't know, I take a business book and I thumb it. I just do like that. And I land on a random page. And if I find value on one, it doesn't have to be both, on one of the two pages, then I think it's a good book. So I just did the thumb test. I landed on page 102. Number 7, I have no context for this. I have not read this book, but in bold print, if thou are planning a soft launch, work a part-time job that offers health benefits. I think that's fantastic counsel.
Wisdom from the sage.
That's right.
Where can I get a copy of this book? I need to buy one for Lee, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Like mentioned earlier, Amazon is the best place to start to find any book, and Guerrillapreneur is on Amazon. Two R's, two L's, and Preneur. Absolutely.
And the best way for our listeners to reach out to you?
I'm also on LinkedIn, Mark Peterson, and we have a Facebook page for the book, Facebook/ Guerrillapreneur, and the website, guerrillapreneur.com.
What an inspiring, engaging conversation, and we want you to sit in the on-deck circle because we probably need to talk with him
after the show.
Now, we need some
but you're based out of Alabama, is that right?
No, I live here in Atlanta. I grew up in Alabama.
Okay.
So I'm
in Alabama. You're here, though, in town?
Yes, I am.
I was born in Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh.
We were born in God's country. And in
God's country, that's right.
Hey, how about hanging with us? We've got one more interview.
Absolutely. I wouldn't miss it.
Terrific. Well, Lee, we have in the studio a lady who is no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, the Business Radio X platform, and she is doing a great deal to head up the effort over there at TEDx Peachtree.
Yes, so you know that we're only 136 days away.
Is that right? See, I did not know that.
I did.
All right. Well, welcome back to the studio, the beautiful Jackie Chu.
It's good to be back, and I'm not an author.
Not yet.
What?
Soon.
You'll tell a story sometime.
I do have 3 blogs. Does that count?
Yeah.
I would think so. You could probably. I bet the Guerrillapreneur could have that in between covers in no time. So what's going on with you and what's happening with TEDx Peachtree?
Well, it's been about 3 months since Al, my co-organizer, was here talking about TEDx Peachtree, and a lot has happened. We've confirmed and secured a venue. It will be at the Buckhead Theater, November 2nd. It's the first Friday, generally, of November every year. We are a once-a-year conference. And we are almost through curating this year's speaker roster. Very, very, very exciting.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's no easy. To get on the speaker roster, you have to jump through a lot of hoops and really make the grade. This is not easily done.
Yes, and by design, Stone, it really is by design. We to preserve the integrity of the larger TED brand and, of course, the whole TEDx, what has become a TEDx movement, we do put very stringent guidelines in place for our speaker submissions. Now, that closed at the end of May this year in terms of submissions, and we've received a whole bunch, a whole pile.
I'll bet.
A whole pile. And we will be selecting, we're in the process of selecting about a dozen or so. And talks range from 6 minutes to 18 minutes. There are different lengths, unlike previous years. Those of you who are familiar, TED Talks are generally 18 minutes or less. They're generally 18 minutes, and they cannot be commercial in nature in any form, fashion, or such. No books, no products, no services, no brands. It has to be about an idea worth sharing. So those are fairly stringent guidelines. Our theme, you know, as you guys know, we have a theme every year. And this year, our theme is Transcend.
Transcend.
So it's sort of an interesting idea and an interesting theme. We've received a really fascinating array of speakers. So I'm here to basically release the first grouping of speakers.
Oh, we're allowed to say.
Yes, now, we're not going to be saying what they're going to talk about, what their idea worth sharing is, but I can share a little bit about this group. And it's a pretty darn August group. So we have J. Walker Smith, who is the executive chairman of the Futures Company. He is, some of you may have known his previous company, which merged with another to form the Futures Company. It's the Yankelovich Group. Some of you here who are in the creative innovation field would probably know Jay. And he's basically a social anthropologist and futurist. So he's going to do what I think is more than a little bit of provocative trend spotting for us during his 18 minutes. Then the other person is Jeff Livingston. And Jeff is a marketer, strategist, social media guru. He works primarily in the nonprofit sector, and he has worked with everyone from the Case Foundation, as in Steve Case, to the United Way of America, some of you rock fans would know this name, Sully Erna. Anybody who we know?
No.
He is? He's a lead singer of Godsmack. Alt rock. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have people in the studio.
We're getting some nod.
All right, we've got some hip folks in here. Awesome. So his talk's going to be sort of provocative as well, and kind of a contrarian talk, if you would. So. And then we also will have Ayoko Chenzira. She's amazing. She is an award-winning filmmaker, documentarian. She has created performance art pieces, films. She's basically done special film commissions in Austria, England, and Brazil. And she has also lectured extensively in Europe, Africa, and, of course, this country. She's known – one of the things that she's known for is she actually co-created the MFA, the Masters of Fine Arts graduate program at the City College of New York,
uh-huh.
As a matter of fact. And in 2002, she was invited to be the very first William and Camille Cosby – as in that Cosby, endowed professor of the arts at Spelman College. So we are really lucky to have her. She is, for those of you who are familiar with the term, she's a transmedia artist, if you would, a transmedia storyteller. Which is,
and she'll be in the colorful sweater. No?
I hope not.
That's what I remember about Cosby, right?
I hope not. Okay, how many of you got those sweaters for Father's Day? So we're really lucky to have her, and hers will be an interactive talk.
Ah.
That involves multimedia. So and we will have several really fascinating inventions from professors from some of the finest universities in this state of Georgia.
What a stellar lineup. And we're going to get a chance to participate. We're going to be conducting a remote broadcast from there like we had the last two times running, right, Lee?
Yes. And but Jackie, since last time we've seen you, you got to go to the TED.
Oh, that's right. You went to the Big Ted. You got to tell us all about that.
Yes, that was 8 days. So there's the Big Ted, as we all affectionately call it worldwide. That's at Long Beach, California, and that happens usually the last week of February, and that's a 4-day conference, and there's a simulcast that happens at Palm Springs, 2.5-3 hours drive away, called TEDActive. And I actually went to the TEDActive version of Big TED. And that was 8 days because of, there were about 250 TEDx organizers from all over the world, including TEDx Bulgaria, Cairo, Tokyo, several from Tokyo or parts of Japan and Korea. And we basically had workshops there ahead of the regular conference. So it was a phenomenal multidisciplinary, multi-sensory, mind-blowing experience. Basically, my brain exploded many, many, many times during my 8 days there.
So any big takeaways? If you're going to boil it down 8 days, you know, to another 2 minutes or so. Go ahead.
Thanks.
We don't have 8 days.
I would say sleep deprivation. is a wonderful thing. Much, much better at my age without the alcohol.
It's a good tip for future TEDxers that are attending. So now, is that a mandatory thing in order to be an organizer of TEDx? You have to go to the TED?
Yes. In order to apply for a license, you would have to, a person would actually have to have attended a Big TED, either a TEDactive, the regular TED, or TED Global. Uh-huh. Which is happening at the end of this month in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm. Well, my hat is off to you. The work that you and Al Myers and your entire team are doing, these are not paid positions. You are all volunteers, professionals in your own right. In fact, you are with a public relations and advertising firm. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Sure. So all of us, and there are five of us in the planning team and on the board, we are a 501c3, and then the half a dozen or so volunteers who help us in the various functions that you would think of in any kind of organization. We are all 100% volunteers. We all have regular jobs during the day, some of us several regular jobs during the day. And so, yes, this is truly a passion, if you would. It's a labor of love and passion and a deep belief that ideas, important ideas, are worth sharing. This is really all about helping folks share their ideas that are worth spreading. And so having said that, yes, I do run, one of the many hats that I wear is I do run a marketing consultancy. We provide fractional CMO services to technology startups, generally startups in the early as well as the middle stage of their growth cycle. I do want to say a couple things about kind of come back to TEDx. Is that okay?
Yeah,
do you guys have a second?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say that we're adding something new this year, guys. So based on popular demand, so many people have come up to us and say, why are you only doing this once a year? And
because
my, the sleep deprivation
yeah,
thing, right?
My answer is because I need to sleep. Well, you asked for it. We're bringing it. We've been granted a TEDx salon license. And what that really means is salons are 3-hour, think of them as round tables, intimate. Our regular TEDx conference is generally 250, 400 people, large conference hall. A TEDx salon is 3 hours, several curated recorded TED Talks, and 30 to 40 people in more intimate settings. And the impetus for this is to basically take ideas into action. So these salons for us and the topic, so each salon will have its own topic, and the topic will be crowdsourced by our community. And for those of you who would like to suggest a topic, if you want to be engaged, go to our Facebook page, TEDx Peachtree Facebook page, and you can go ahead and we will be making announcements there about the salon. It's August 27th. It's an evening program. It would be from 6 to 9. It's really a low commitment, low time commitment type of event, but very, very interactive.
There's got to be innovation in the air at that thing, Bob.
There always is, you know, and even just watching YouTube videos of the TEDx stuff is it's feeding the minds of many, many people. It's a great thing.
And you got to be all over this idea, too. You must really appreciate the kind of the thought leadership that comes out of these TED Talks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Try to be a real student of all of this strategic, innovative thinking. And as much as I can consume, I try to, you know, keep doing it. Great, great stuff.
Well, and you guys make it so accessible. What a wonderful event, but beyond the event, it's so accessible.
That is exactly, it's all about the ideas, it's all about sharing the ideas, and actually, so of the 170 talks that were done by TEDx events that were selected to be featured on TED.com, TEDx Peachtree actually has three of them. We actually have three speakers.
Wow.
We think that we were probably the only TEDx with the largest number of TEDx speakers on that virtual stage, and it's pretty exciting.
Might have something to do with having someone on senior staff that knows a thing or two about marketing.
That's right. I'm sure that helps.
You think that's a coincidence?
Now, I think Georgia has fantastic speakers.
A lot of talent.
Yes.
Now, TEDx Peachtree, like we said, is a volunteer organization. Is it something you're always looking for sponsors? Are there sponsor opportunities? Are there volunteer opportunities?
I'm just so glad you asked that. We still have several sponsorship opportunities left. We are getting into high gear in terms of we will shortly be announcing more of the speakers as well as making tickets available for sale. So if you guys want to know how to be amongst the first to know, go to our Facebook page, TEDx Peachtree.
Now, can you explain what a sponsor would get?
Sure.
Like what's in it for the sponsor?
So, you know, this is, as we've had a lot of conversations with companies, and this is really not for every company. It's in terms of an ROI, you really do, you know, the immediate ROI as a lead generation exercise, this would not be the conference for you.
Right. Who's the optimal speaker? Sponsor.
However, the kind of companies that would really benefit from this is companies that are already forward thinking, that already have an innovative mindset, or if they have a transformation that they're going through, that they're undergoing, and they have a fuller appreciation for ideas and for new, for out of the box. I really hate using these cliches, but in general, for creative, what was it? Creative disruption.
Strategic chaos.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Companies that are more bent towards disruption and strategic chaos, those are the companies that would find the community that come to our events, who come to our conferences, to be very willing recipients of their ideas.
Well, and think about it from a branding point of view. If I'm a company that wants to attract and retain highly innovative, creative, and curious talent, and I'm branded in a TEDx or a TED conference, I'm saying to that potential employee pool, we're cool. We like curious people. We want people that are learning new things, and curiosity is the thing that feeds the brain, that makes the connections, that is creative, and drives innovation. So that's a real win-win from a branding point of view, from an employee retention innovation perspective.
Yeah, internally too, because I can see wanting to sponsor it not only for the recruiting effect, but I'd want to sponsor it and buy a block of tickets for my employees to demonstrate beyond any shadow of a doubt.
Yep.
We are cool. We are hip. Yep. We mean all this stuff that we say.
And feed their brain. Where does innovation occur? It occurs in those interstitial spaces between ideas when we connect one thing with another. And the more likely we do that, the better off.
Okay, how are we going to spell interstitial on the blog post behind us? Everything was going great, right?
Word
until
for
you
the
said,
day. That's right.
Interstitial?
There you go. Word
but
for
I'm
the
sure
day.
You're right, because I know you're the expert on it. So, Jackie, November 2nd, Buckhead Theater. Let's once again make sure we've got the right coordinates for people to learn more about this stuff and get their hands on some tickets and learn more about sponsor opportunities.
They can go to TEDxPeachtree.com. which is our website, and there are videos there from previous years, and they can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/TEDxPeachtree.
perfect. Find your interstitial self.
There you go. It's all there.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, our guests this morning, Karen Stedman, Bob Eckert, Mark Anthony Peterson, and Jackie Chu, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.